a brighter day is here. Good morning, may we bring you cheer.
We've got time, we've got tunes, we've got time, tunes, and temperature.
Get up and go, it's today, you know, on KSCO Radio.
Okay, good morning there. It is 7 minutes past the hour, and my guest is not here, so we're going to kind of wing it this morning. This would be the opening song I would play, or will play if they get on, so just listen to this real quick.
He smiles at the young soldiers, tells them it's all right. He knows of their fear in the forthcoming fight. Soon there'll be blood. Many will die. Mothers and fathers back home they will cry.
That's a song by Eric Burton and the Animals from the 60s during the Vietnam War. My guest was supposed to be a woman by the name of Nadia McCaffrey, whose son was recently killed in Iraq. And she made headline news, certainly in Sacramento and nationally for the most part, because she had her son flown back on a private airline. And he was flown back to Sacramento. His coffin was flag-draped, and apparently we have rules against that. For some reason, the administration does not want flag-draped coffins shown on the media. I don't have any problem with that. You know, our soldiers that die in combat have the right to have our respect, and they come back. They should come back, and we should see that. That's not a problem. Anyway, she has been making the circuit, and my producer scheduled her today. I don't know if she's going to call in or if we're supposed to call her. But in the meantime, we can talk about that. We can talk about the Iraq War. I thought it was interesting because I was not quite sure what I was going to talk to her about. Clearly, any time someone dies in combat, it's a tragedy to the people that lose them. But I don't know that this story is all that much different than the Pat Tillman story, in that what we have here is a soldier that went to Afghanistan and died in the process of combat. I picked that piece because I like that song. If you've listened to it through and through, Sky Pilot, I don't know quite what to say about it. I think it is the minister, the priest, the clergyman that blesses the soldiers that literally are the ones that go out and do the fighting, you know, and he's the Sky Pilot that says his prayers over them. Hang on a second. So anyway, in the absence of a guest, some of the things that we thought about this week for Saturday specials had to do, first of all, I wanted to try and get Bruce McPherson on and John Laird and Gary Knudsen. I thought that would be an interesting Saturday special, given the fact that we are still in July. July is almost over, and they still haven't passed a budget up there in Sacramento. And everyone got upset about the government calling our legislators girly men. I thought it would have been fun to have the senator and legislator, congressman up here, and ask them how come they can never pass a budget on time. Clearly, Bruce has been up there sometime. John Laird is on his first term. Why is it that these guys can never pass a budget on time? Just can't pass one. You know, listen, they pass over 1,000 laws a year are signed, 1,000 bills per year are signed into law. They sponsor more than that. But 1,000 get passed, and they present them to the governor, and they get signed into law. That's roughly 3 laws a day. If they can spend that much time legislating, why can't they sit down and do one of the most important things, if not the only thing that they should get done up there, and that is pass a budget. Pass a budget. You know, I understand the girly men thing. That was funny. That was interesting. But what I absolutely found interesting is the news media at large did not hold anybody accountable as to why we still don't have a budget. Why these guys, year after year after year, not only overspend our money, steal money from the counties and cities, put their money-grubbing hands on every cent they can get on, but they can't even get their budget passed on time. They can't even do the one thing that's important for them to get done. So we can talk about that if you want to call in, 479-10-80, 477-1340. Another thing that I suggested for my producer is I did work when I got back from Vietnam and I was in junior college in the early 70s. I met a man by the name of Bill Fennekel, and he was teaching organic chemistry at the junior college I went to, and his main area of interest and expertise was extraction and identification of potentially useful chemical compounds that could be found in plant life from the ocean. So what he would do is write grants and go out and comb the oceans of this great world, looking for plant life, bring them back to the lab, and we'd put them in a homogenizer, and we start looking for things. Because it turns out that the antibiotic age is actually quite new, fairly short-lived, and we don't really have anything to replace penicillin. And it turns out that from an organic chemistry standpoint, it's hard to generate some of these antibiotic bases. And they recently did a piece on 60 Minutes wherein they said, we just don't have anything. Our most effective compounds, antibiotics for fighting bacteria and things, there's no money in it. See, the problem with antibiotics for drug companies is there's no money in it. Because if you get sick, you're treated with the antibiotic, and you may never need to use it again. And so, consequently, we find a lot of the drug companies focusing their attentions these days on the drugs that people want, all the Viagras, the Cialis, and all that. Anyway, Bill would have been a very interesting, very, very interesting guest, in my opinion, because we would have sat here and discussed what's involved in finding these potentially useful compounds for generating new antibiotics, because it does turn out that plant life has long been a source of the organic basis for things that have been useful to us. It looks like my guest has called in, or Erin got a hold of her. Either way, it doesn't matter. So we'll go ahead and pick her up in a second here, and let me get her, make sure her phone line's turned up, and we'll go and we'll pick up, let's see, we need to do the KZ editorial at some point during the show. Okay, I'll let you know. Erin, you're so great. Okay, I'll bring Nadia up, and we'll see what we have here. Nadia, welcome to KSCO, the Saturday special. My name is Vernon Bohr, a.k.a. Vernon, a.k.a. V Cubed. And thanks for calling in. And so I'll throw it over to you. What do you want to say to us this morning? Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
This is Nadia McCaffrey.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm very good.
Thank you for letting me on the show.
Uh-huh. You're welcome. My understanding is that your son, right after 9/11, this is the gist of what I know. He enrolled in the National Guard because he wanted to do something for his country. He wanted to serve it in some way. The unit was called up, sent to Iraq, and he was killed in June. And where you came to the forefront, from my understanding, is that when you had his body shipped back, you had it shipped commercial, so the coffin was flag-draped, which I guess there's an administration ban against that for military flights bringing caskets back, and as such, you're on the circuit sharing your son's life with the public. Is that kind of an accurate lead-in?
Sort of, yeah. The option of having my son back commercially or not was not an option. That's the way it came.
Okay.
And why I did this, asked the media to be there, or agree with the media to have it filmed and photographed. Why? Yes. Well, the reason for this is very simple. The first of the reasons that I did it is for my grandchildren. My granddaughter is 2 years old. She will never remember her dad. But right now, she's remembering her dad leaving for Iraq, waving at us from a plane, stepping in a plane, and this is the way he came home, in this coffin with a flag over it. So, my grandson is 9 years old. He, for the moment, remembers that, yes. But 15 years from now, the pictures, the images are going to fade in his mind, and he will forget, partly, if not completely. So the films, the pictures taken, will be there to remind both of them how their dad came home, and myself, and Patrick's dad. And also for all the mother out there who have been going through what I am going through. Also to all the mothers who will go through what I am going through. And we can add to that all the families, the military families. This is the truth. This is what happened. This is it.
I'm almost speechless. I happen to be a Vietnam veteran, and there are many listeners in the audience that are Vietnam veterans, and clearly, I think that many times it is underappreciated or under noticed by society, the loss of our soldiers. A soldier is a very interesting entity in my opinion. They're probably one of the most, it's probably one of the most thankless jobs there is for any person to engage in. And we send people off to war. Many don't come back. The ones that do come back, like your son, lead to the loss and grief of many families. And so in essence, you want people to appreciate the loss and cost of lives in this particular war?
Yes. This is a reality. It's not a dream. It's not something far behind that people think it's there, but not really. This is really here. This is really happening today. And yes, we have to realize this very clearly. Okay? And I want people to know who my son was for many reasons. The first one, I think he was an example. And the reason why I'm saying this, not because he's my son, but because, frankly, I did not realize to what point of a wonderful person he was when he was alive. I did to a point. Oh, I loved him dearly. He was my life. But I never understood to what degree this man was so wonderful.
You're not. Might I extend that to the fact that on our bigger picture, that none of us, I think that there's a real tendency in life and amongst us as people to underappreciate those close to us?
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I understand the tragedy of war, but life is like that. It's so tenacious. It can be taken from us like that. At the moment of loss, there's no opportunity whatsoever to go back. And I think frequently people at that point in time really realize how much that person meant to them, mm-hmm. with all their annoying characteristics.
Yeah, because you see, it's not just to me.
What I'm saying in the larger sense and picture,
yeah, okay,
is human beings and humanity. Mm-hmm. We tend to underappreciate those that are close to us, and sometimes it takes death, or sometimes it's only in death. That's what I got from you a second ago.
Right.
That we truly get a full appreciation of what made up that human being.
Mm-hmm. The reason also that I want to make clear, and it's not just for Patrick here, it's for many other soldiers. Patrick worked, he's from Sunnyvale, he grew up in Sunnyvale, graduated from Homestead High School in Cupertino. He, after this, worked at Aikens Collision Repair in Palo Alto for 13 years. He was a manager, and when he died, general manager of Aikens of two shops. So he was well paid. He had a very comfortable life. He bought a house in Tracy. That's where I am talking to you right now. Patrick was fine. He did not need to enlist to make extra money to go to college or whatever sometimes people do. It's not a critique on any way. It's just a precision on who he was. All right? And when he joined the Guard, the day after 9/11, he wanted to make a difference. He wanted to do something for his country. People reacted. I reacted. Everyone did. What happened was, and this, we don't have a precise word to describe how horrible that was. So we did react. And that was his way of reacting. But when he enlisted with the guards two men to him to stay home, to be here for people in case of another emergency, another catastrophe. The guards are here to help out people within the country. What we have to understand is that this is the first time since World War II that the National Guard have been deployed overseas to combat. Okay? And no, Patrick did not have any idea when he enlisted that he would end up in Iraq and die.
So you would say, you're saying that he was enlisted under false pretenses?
No, I'm not saying this. I'm describing to you what happened.
Okay.
The changes within the system did this, okay? I'm not blaming anyone.
No, I understand that, yeah.
Uh-huh. I want the young men out there to realize, you know, what happened. Because in some people's mind, the guard, well, you know, he was another soldier who was killed. Fine, yes, he is. But also, there was a difference between the time he enlisted and, yes, the way he thought he was doing it and the way it happened. Okay? So the result of this is that he was not even covering his bills with the money that he was paid by the guards. And what happened next was that he had to do another mortgage on his house, not to lose it. And so Sylvia and the children would not suffer about, you know, different bills until he gets back. He would be back.
How long? He enlisted right after 9/11.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, needless to say, several years ago. And when was his unit called up and activated and sent over there?
March
of this year. So everything was fine. He was just doing normal National Guard duty. What do they have,
yes.
a monthly meeting or something like that?
Yes, exactly.
And then in the summer they go for a couple weeks, I believe,
uh-huh.
Something like that. So
right, it's a weekend a month, it was. And yes, they're supposed to go, I think, like you say, a week in the summer to for special training. That's it. And in case of emergency, of course, then they will be deployed within the country wherever needed.
And so, needless to say, that when his unit was called up, activated, and sent to Iraq, mm-hmm. he could no longer do his normal work, everyday chores at the body shop, which was the major source of income. And you're saying at that particular point in time, his income was insufficient to take care of his family. Really,
the guards, yes, the army, because the guards are under the army, was not covering his bills. No.
What would you know, I think it's interesting. I know that I didn't personally realize until relatively recently the extent that we have started to use the National Guard as our main military. And I certainly have some problems with that because
yeah.
I know we have a volunteer military, and in the to the extent that our volunteer military suffices to do the job, that's okay. But I think that I do tend to agree with you. When a load is put on a National Guard like that, that's a problem. Do you think we should bring back the draft?
Yeah. Well, there are many questions come up. I don't have the answer to this. Okay.
Uh huh.
But the thing is that we have to face another. I realized, you know, afterward, and this people should understand it and face it. Those who are, you know, involved in this. For example, Patrick's unit did not get the same advantage because they were englobed by the, under the, or embedded, I guess you said, with the 81st Brigade from Washington. The Petaluma unit that he was attached to only counted, when they were deployed, 300 men. And out of the 300 men, there is only not even 90 left now in Camp Anaconda. So the Patrick's unit did not get the same privileges and advantage as the 81st Brigade or the other units. Their equipment was not exactly up to date, far from that. For example, Patrick, when he was ambushed along with Lieutenant Tyson, who also was killed with him, and another American soldier who is now recovering, thank God, from the ambush. He also was shot multiple times, but he's going to make it. What happened was, it's not clear. The attack, the ambush, everything is not clear. There is two or three reports on this, and the way it happened to Patrick anyway, he was attacked from both sides of his body at the same time, left and right, with automatic weapon and shot multiple times in the chest. Massive internal bleeding, of course, happened immediately. His bulletproof vest was useless. And he dropped. He actually, when they found the three men on the ground, they thought that Patrick was dead when he actually had a very feeble pulse. I'm not saying that they didn't do what they were supposed to do. Those people did everything they could do to save him. He was very loved, and they did everything in their power to try to save his life, okay? But the way he was attacked, he didn't have a chance anyway. Now, on the other hand, the bulletproof vest, what is the use of wearing one if it's not going to stop anything?
When I was in Vietnam, we used to have flak jackets, and I used to ask myself the same question, because I don't think the flak jackets of those days stopped military rounds, you know, rifle rounds and stuff. I think that maybe if you had a grenade that went off within a certain distance, it may save you, so it was better than nothing. But I always had the same question.
Mm-hmm. And, if you need get the old one, they didn't get the new one. You know, this is a problem.
Well, that is certainly a tragedy. There's clearly, from my perspective here, is that if our military is going to be sent any place to any sort of engagement, they need to have the best equipment possible, number one, and the best support possible, and they don't need their hands tied. That's one of the main problems I have with what's going on over there is we go through tremendous lengths. And I'm not saying that life is not important, by the way, but tremendous lengths to respect the Iraqi people, you know, notwithstanding the prison scandal, but at the cost and expense of our men.
Uh-huh. There is a few things that I would like to share with you, if you don't mind.
Be my guest.
For example, when Patrick realized he was going to be deployed, he didn't want to go, he didn't want to leave his family, okay? He just didn't. But he and I sat, and he wanted to tell me first because he didn't want me to hear it from somebody else. Patrick is my only child, okay? So, of course, yes.
That makes the loss even heavier.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm talking about it so much, because I don't want... I would like to stop it, frankly. But it's another story. I'm going to do everything I can for that, but that's another story. In any way, when he realized he was going to be drafted, deployed, he tried to make some sense out of it. And he said, Mom, look, you have to understand one thing here. The day I signed those papers, I took a responsibility. And I'm going to stand up to it. And you know what? I totally respect that. I probably would have done the same thing, without question. So he did. And once he was deployed, he would call every 2 days, because he was worried that we worry about him, okay? So that was a routine with him. Now, to get to a phone, they still have to wait 2 hours in line outside. There is no building practically. There is just a couple of buildings standing. The rest is tents. They had to wait 2 hours in 125 degrees of heat to get to a phone and to talk to their family. And on top of that, it's very expensive. So Patrick asked me to try to do something with this and to raise some money or to have some donation from different company for 3 satellite phones. Now, Washington, 81st, got 3 satellite phones from the governor. But what about California? So we had to do something about it, and I started to do this. And I was getting some donation in and so on, and the Army stopped me and said, you can't do this because of security reasons. We cannot allow it to happen. Fine. Now, what was the next step to this? I sent some phone cards, but they don't last long, and, you know, I'll go. So that was not the answer. So after this, they, over there at camp, tried to put up a, what they call now an internet cafe with two laptops. But the situation is kind of the same. With only two laptops for 100 people, for 90-some people, you have to wait a long time before you get access. You know, you can access a computer for a few minutes, okay? So the answer to this would be to have 5 to 7 laptops. Then that would work pretty good. And actually, this is the last time I saw Patrick on the laptop at the Armory in Santa Rosa for Father's Day. And when I saw him on the screen of that computer, I know he was not coming home. I just know then that was the last time I saw him. Yeah.
So what I hear, as part of your mission is what we can do as private citizens out here to show our support and love for our troops or people that are overseas.
Yes, and I'm doing it. I'm not going to stop doing this because he's gone. He asked me to do this for them, and I will do it. I'm doing it now. And I think we should, as individual, try to do the same and pay a little interest.
So that's really an interesting point. You know, I've been listening intently, and at the heart of let me recap what I think I'm hearing. Okay,
right, yeah.
Is the heart of what I'm hearing is that you want the way you want to make your son's death make a difference is to bring people's consciousness and awareness to the fact that we as citizens, there's things we can do beyond patriotic speeches to really support and make a difference with our troops over there. For
yes.
example, one is people can, of their own volition, find out what's wanted and needed. In this case, laptops are one thing.
Yeah.
And get those. There are ways to support the troops that we as citizens can do mm-hmm. that we should be doing.
Yes. I agree totally with this, and this is what I'm asking, actually. You see, there is this, but there are other things like... Now, not everybody was privileged like Patrick because he had enough money to cover for the phone, to cover for packages and things. He even asked us to send loads of packages for the children. Because to get back to the point after he started, after he was just deployed, when he first arrived in Iraq, he was very open to the new situation, and he said, well, maybe after all I can do something here and make a difference with the Iraqi people and help them, you know. Well, one thing that happened very, very shortly, the first mission he was out, he called back, and his voice was very heavy. Patrick was a very positive and happy person, but this time was very heavy voice. And he says, Mom, I don't know why we're here. Those people just plain hate us. They don't want us here. And it's not just American. It's everyone who doesn't belong in the country. European as well as anybody who is here doesn't belong here. They plain hate us. And I said, Patrick, why do you say that? He said, Mom, picture this. We just go on mission, okay? We are 3 or 4 MVs and a truck and so on. And when we go through some small town, villages, whatever you want to call them, people show the fist, they throw things at them, insult them. If not, they just stare with hatred. It's very clear. There is no question. They don't want us here. And he was very hurt by that. His heart was broken by that, plain and simple. Okay? So what happened after this? He turned to the Iraqi children and to his fellow soldier. He also was a lifesaver, combat lifesaver. Which means if you, for example, collapse from heat exhaustion or wounded or whatever, he would be the first one here to help you with IV or whatever needs to be done.
Was he a medic? What was his main job within the unit?
Yes. Well, yes, it was one of the main ones. And I'm getting to the next one just after that. So this was the thing that he took very much at heart. And he did help quite a few people. I mean, the people who came to his memorial were hundreds of people, and I heard from thousands of people so far, from Iraq, Europe, and the United States. People that he has touched lives, people that he saved lives. You know, it's amazing. I'm discovering all of that. Okay? So, but this part of life, combat lifesaver to him was very important. So he would watch over the soldier. And since he was 34, he was, you know, one of the oldest. He was not 20 or so on. And he really was like a father figure. So he was also well known in camp Anaconda to walk through the camp. And what he did, he wear a picture around of our cord with some pictures of his family around his neck. Children, wife, and I was in the back with his dad of the fold, the older. And he would show that to everybody. And when he would spot, for example, a soldier who was sitting down crying or depressed, there is a lot of depression. Morale is very bad, okay, over there. And there is a lot of suicidal situation. So Patrick would walk to the soldier spotted, and he would just hug the guy. And he just would say, you know, cheer up until he make him laugh and invite him, you know, by his unit and so on and, you know, cheer people up. And he was very well known for that. This was one of the things that he did. Now, when he died, the day he died, he was carrying a radio on his back for his unit. The radio weighs 75 pounds. All right? The way things were supposed to go is that each soldier was supposed to carry the radio for a certain amount of time. Well, nobody could do it. It's 125 degrees. The terrain is atrocious. The day he died, they had 2 hours sleep. And the mission started at 3 o'clock in the morning. He was killed at 11:45 in the morning. They were walking for 5 hours straight. No breakfast, just walking through a terrible terrain. When Patrick died again, that radio was on his back. And what happened was, he told the soldier, he said, don't worry, from now on, and this was not that day, it happened quite a few days before that, I will carry that radio for you. So each mission, Patrick was carrying the radio. Their gear alone are something around like 60 pounds, plus 75 pounds of radio, okay?
Uh-huh. I was always amazed by that. By the way, I had many friends who were airborne when I was in the Army, and to think of those guys doing the airborne shuffle out the back of a plane with all that gear, 100 yes. pounds plus of gear, is pretty incredible.
Yes, it is. To me, I can't see it, okay? I just can't.
In fact, to that extent, there was a, just as a side note here, for the listening audience, 479-1080, 477-1340, if you have anything you want to call and ask Nadia about her son, Iraq, what you can do for the soldiers.